Comedy Rapport with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, August 20th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Benjamin Dixon of The Benjamin Dixon Show will be joining us, and then we will be joined by Dan from the Internet of The Power Report, an audio face, later in the show. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, Kabul's airport continues to be mired in chaos as thousands of Afghans were beaten by the Taliban as they tried to board flights out of the country. The United Nations has warned that the Taliban are rounding up Afghans who they suspect worked with the U.S. or the previous Afghan government, conducting door-to-door visits. In Washington, a man who claimed to have a bomb in his pickup truck outside of the Library of Congress surrendered to police after hours of negotiations. On a live stream beforehand, the man was seemingly threatening Joe Biden and has expressed support for Donald Trump. Go figure. Three new senators who are vaccinated have tested positive for coronavirus: Independent Angus King of Maine, Republican Roger Wicker of Mississippi, and Democrat John Hickenlooper of Colorado. All report mild symptoms. As the Delta variant rages across the country, the Alabama Hospital Association says the entire state has negative 29 ICU beds. None. Less than none. Biden cancels federal student loan debt for over 300,000 disabled borrowers, proving that he can do it for everybody if he just wanted to. And lastly, more details about the devastating effects of the earthquake in Haiti are trickling out. A major oxygen plant, one of the few on the island necessary to treat COVID patients, has been severely damaged. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gents. It is Friday. It's a very casual Friday. I'm feeling burnt out this week. I'm excited for the weekend. I don't know about you. I think a lot of the news has been so heavy, whether it's the Delta variant, whether it's the Afghanistan withdrawal, just the images that we're seeing there, and of course the weight of the media's opposition to trying to end our wars. That's been difficult to combat in and of itself. Not that we're some heroes here, but it's just been, you know, a frustrating week.
I understand all those feelings. My current sort of temperament is energized by ongoing scandal in the Minnesota Republican Party, which we'll get to in the fun half.
We will get to that in the fun half. Matt may even make an on-camera appearance to break this down with us because, you know, he's got all the info. So
it's time to break out the shovels, folks.
Yes, and unfortunately he didn't wear his Minnesota Timberwolves hat to talk about this today. You went with the Orioles.
I might sneak away and go buy one on Fulton.
Yeah. Well, we still have some idiocy to get to before we talk to Ben Dixon. Now, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick of Texas, people might remember him for a variety of reasons, but mostly he became infamous at the start of the coronavirus pandemic. Not sure if you've ever heard of it. For advocating that grandma and grandpa should be sacrificed at the altar of capitalism so we didn't have to close down the economy. Basically saying that they would want the economy for their kids to be robust, and so they're fine with dying of COVID. Yeah, that's that kind of guy. Well, he's back on Fox News, where he originally made those statements back in early 2020. This time on Laura Ingraham's show. Here he is engaging in the latest Republican brand of whataboutism, they've been dancing around using this argument tactic for a bit, but now it seems like they're diving headfirst in on vaccination rates. He's trying to direct ire away from himself and Governor Greg Abbott in Texas as their ban on masks and promotion of vaccine hesitancy is having a deadly effect on their population.
We're coming after your state really quickly here, and as a response, coming after your state, yes, because the increased COVID numbers, hospitalizations, deaths are up in Texas, and there's a direct assault on your governor's policies and your state's policies. Yeah. Very brief response.
Yeah. Well, Laura, the COVID is spreading, particularly most of the numbers are with the unvaccinated, and the Democrats like to blame Republicans on that. Well, the biggest group in most states are African-Americans who have not been vaccinated. And the last time I checked, over 90% of them vote for Democrats in their major cities and major counties. So it's up to the Democrats to get, just as it's up to Republicans, to try to get as many people vaccinated. But we respect the fact that if people don't want the vaccination, we're not going to force it on them. That's their individual right. But in terms of criticizing the Republicans for this, we're encouraging people who want to take it to take it. But they're doing nothing for the African-American community that has a significant high number of unvaccinated
TikTok
people.
Videos.
So they need
we got a lot of TikTok.
Yes. TikTok. I don't know where she got that part from. But here's the thing. Yeah, Black Americans' vaccination rates are lower than some other groups in many areas, but not as low as Republicans.
Well, and also probably not for the same reasons. We've talked all the times about barriers to getting vaccinated are correlated with class sort of things, which are in this country very correlated with race.
I'm going to get to that, I swear. So, like, let's just pull up this then Washington Post and Kaiser Family Foundation chart from a few weeks back. So you can see here, Democrats and white Democrats have the highest percentage of having had at least one dose, and the definitely won't get, the purple on the end there, is very, very little. Then you see white adults in bold. There are a bunch of other different categories there. Black adults are behind them, but not too far behind them. And right at the bottom there, you see Republicans and white Republicans. And you will see also that the purple is a lot higher for them, right? And uninsured under 65, it's cut off, I think, a little bit here, but that's actually the lowest demographic because, as Matt said, poverty is a major factor. But as you see, the definitely won't get for Republicans and white Republicans higher than all of the other groups except evangelical Christians, who are very similar right down at the bottom. We're good with that chart there. But like, as Matt said, poverty is the number one factor inextricably tied with race in this country. And a lot of that, it has to do with misinformation about being charged for the vaccine. That's why you see uninsured under 65 as being the number one demo that hasn't at least gotten one dose. Two, poor people are not able to take off work to get the vaccine, and they're also worried about getting sick after the jab. And three, Black Americans also have generational trauma of medical abuse by the state. And so, like, as I said, in that chart, though, they're a lot less likely than Republicans in general to say that they will get the vaccine.
Right, in spite of this country's history of sort of just medical neglect and abuse of Black people, their numbers are higher than white Republicans.
Right, and so, like, it's just a disingenuous argument from the get-go. And it's a way to whitewash, no pun intended, their deliberate vaccine misinformation that's coming out of one party. It's coming out of one side. It's coming from Republicans.
This is like ghoulish. Ghoulish, Daniel Bessner informed me, is usually when you speak ill or, I think, over the dead. The way that in the midst of a rising not only case rate but death rate for COVID, to talk about an, quote, assault on your policies. No, people are dying and they want to hold the state responsible because that's who is responsible.
Right. And so, and of course, in Texas, the state is run by Republicans who are using this pandemic as a political opportunity to sap the idea of collective action and, well, not more just like public response in the pandemic of banding together. They're using that to undercut that concept. They're using this period of time to undercut that concept. So, as I said, it's disingenuous from the get-go. And one side is saying, get vaccinated, and the other side is fear-mongering about it. And they're making a necessary feature of a pandemic response into a personal choice, which is part of that overall project, as I mentioned before. But also, when you make vaccines about personal choices, and then people are encouraging you to get vaccinated, and then you feel like it's an infringement on your personal choice, you're more likely to get outraged. And a lot of what Republicans want are for people to be outraged on a local, granular level so that they are engaged with the GOP in all elections, state, local, federal, what have you. And so I haven't seen a big Republican go as far as Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick there quite yet, in explicitly blaming black people for vaccination rates, but that has been percolating behind the scenes for quite a while, and he finally said the quiet part out loud, and it's just as bad as it appeared to be. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We got some ads, and when we come back, we will be joined by Benjamin Dixon of The Benjamin Dixon Show.
Hey, today's episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Sunset Lake Cebede. SunsetLakeCebede.com. Sunset Lake is my go-to for tinctures that help me with sleeping, salve that helps me with really, I mean, it's supposed to help muscle aches, has arnica in it. But frankly, I use it for my eczema, and I've found a lot of relief from it. They've got hemp-infused hand lotion. They've got fudge and great-tasting coffee that's infused with Cebede, which is my weekend brew. They've got gummies. They've got smokables. They've got pre-rolls. All of it, highest quality. They have third parties who test it and put all the results on their website, and will send it to you as well. Plus, they have great business practices, $15 minimum wage, companies mostly employee-owned. They have great farming practices, no pesticides. They use integrated pest management as a way of dealing with pests, and 100% organic fertilizer. They work with the University of Vermont for their regenerative agriculture practices. And now they have a new feature, which they don't call it this, but I call it the Sam Cedar feature, if you will. It is basically allows you, where do I have it here? Well, it is, you know that with Left is Best, you get 20% off of anything there. Coupon code Left is Best. Well, now, for folks who might be like me, that you need to habitualize everything, you don't want to reach over at, you know, you go into bed and find that your tincture is empty. Well, now you can get easily, you can easily get their handcrafted Cebede products from Sunset Lake Cebede automatically delivered to your door every month with a 25% discount. This is great for you if you're like me, you want to automate everything, or if you know somebody who might have trouble ordering online and to do it repeatedly. Maybe sometimes they forget, maybe it's just difficult for them to navigate the internet. This subscription service from Sunset Lake Cebede will be a huge help. Check it out now, www.sunsetlakecebede.com. Today's show also sponsored by a product that I was using well before they became an advertiser of this show. I've told this story before, but it bears repeating because it is it's a great story. My sisters and I wanted to make sure that my mom was eating properly. She's going through a little bit of health issues and wanted to make it easier for her so she didn't have to cook any food. And we came across, you know, we basically, well, my sister did. I didn't do the work. She looked for the best reviewed service that would bring food to somebody's house. And it was called Freshly. We had to tell my mom because we knew that she wouldn't let us pay for those meals, as reasonable as they are, that they were advertising on the show. And they'd give me lifetime free meals. And I basically just told them to send them to my mom. And my mother has been loving Freshly for well over 2 years now. And every time I would talk to her, she would say, the Freshly stuff is so great. I can't believe you're so lucky to have them advertised. And I've told my friends it's delicious. And the thing with Freshly is your meals arrive cooked. They arrive fresh every week. You keep them in your fridge. You heat them up. I don't know. It just takes about 3 minutes. Ordering is super easy. You go to Freshly.com. You choose from over 30 meals, like my mom's favorite, steak peppercorn, or you can get the sausage baked penne or their chicken pesto bowl. They have tons of other recipes. And of course, you can also go online and order on behalf of your mom or your dad or anybody yourself, obviously. They have a variety of plans. They have a bunch of different meals to pick from. And now our listeners can try Freshly for just $6.16 per meal. That's right. Great opportunity for you to try it. You will find how much you love it and how convenient it is. Right now, Freshly is offering our listeners $40 off your first two orders when you go to Freshly.com/majority. Stop stressing about dinner. Go to Freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. That's Freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. We put links to all the things we advertise in our YouTube and our podcast descriptions. Check it out. Emma.
And we are back here with the one and only Ben Dixon of the Benjamin Dixon Show, friend of the show. Ben, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Thanks for having me. And it is Friday, so I'm doing even better.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like I was saying before this, at the start of the show, kind of a heavy week. One of the heaviest weeks that we've had since, I mean, the latest Israel Palestine conflict, I guess, is what I think in terms of just the complete emotional weight of the news. Or January 6th was another really difficult week, but I think the frustration about the entire media apparatus uniting behind one narrative when it comes to Biden's withdrawal in Afghanistan, that really that was really frustrating to watch. I'm wondering what your take is on that.
Yeah, it's been a fascinating narrative. And I also want to throw in the earthquake in Haiti and just mention my co-host, Rebecca Azor, who's lost some family members there. It's been a heavy week between that, Afghanistan, and COVID-19. It's just been, like you said, it's been kind of heavy. In regards to the narrative of Afghanistan, it is such a ubiquitous narrative that I had to wake up from my from my deathbed this morning and call into my own show to speak to make sure I register my dissent with one of my co-hosts and their position on Afghanistan, because the narrative has really sunk deep in the mainstream media that this was an abject failure by Joe Biden. But I'm looking at all the pieces as they fall. It is so choreographed that I can't think that this is actually a failure. I think that this was planned because it's just too neatly done in terms of the public relations. And the only people that really have a problem with what's happening is the mainstream media. But you got to consider who their sponsors are.
Right. And so I also think that it's not just sponsors, too. It's also sources with lot of these national security reporters. They take what their sources say very seriously. They develop these relationships. And like, there's very little big picture understanding of these Langley sources, these, you know, FBI sources, what have you, there's a bunch of intel that they could give to you. And they're giving you specific intel for a purpose.
That's right.
And so, like, the always the conclusion is, well, we have to remain here. We have to invade here because that's curated for that exact purpose.
That's right. It is, and I think we... It's one of those situations where we really have to understand one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist kind of perspective, because we automatically insert ourselves into the conversation. The observer, we inject ourselves into the international conversation through the lens of America and democracy and spreading freedom. When in reality, we are Darth Vader on the international stage. We are the galactic empire. We are the people that many nations have to survive simply because we have decided to occupy their territory for 20, 30, 40, 60 years. And so the narrative that is being spun by the mainstream media absolutely has a connection to their assets on the ground. And so we call those assets, from the American perspective, we call them our allies. But from the people who are on the ground, some of them, Those are the Judases that worked in conjunction with the greatest empire in the history of the planet to occupy that nation for 20 years.
Right. And saying that to anybody covering this, their heads would explode, because that's right. there's like such this like childlike American exceptionalism that is an undercurrent of so much of what the press does here. And it's also inflating their own importance in, well, we're covering these grave threats and we are a part of, and I'm not besmirching media in general, but I am besmirching a lot of national security reporters. Like, that part of the media is a real cesspool.
That's right. Because what they're not going to tell you is that if you take a course on national security at a master's level or even a doctoral level, and they outline the top four security priorities for the United States, number one is not democracy and freedom. Number one, literally in our courses that we do this on an academic level based on the research, the number one national security implication for the United States has always been capitalism. Always has been. And so we have to understand it through that lens. We're not going there to spread democracy. When have we spread democracy in the last 60 years? Right. You can make the argument about our interaction and going into World War II. That's a justifiable one. And I'll argue on the side of America in that perspective. But in terms of everything else, Vietnam, you know,
we did the cleanup in World War II. The Soviets lost many more people than we did. And that's not a part of our.
And that's not part of our common understanding because of the narrative of capitalism versus communism and the ensuing Cold War. But there's just so many layers here that is unnecessarily. No, it's not unnecessary. It's intentionally reduced to intentional obtuseness because they need the general public to automatically say anything that is against America is automatically bad. But I'm sorry, I know what America does on the international stage, so we should know better.
So what did you think about Biden's response to this then? Because, you know, I thought it was largely good. I think Sam was talking about how he wished it was included in a broader critique of American imperialism and like making it not just about this conflict and our men and women dying overseas for nothing, but more just about, this foreign policy set that we have engaged in for decades and decades, it's a part of a massive problem of American might and imperialism. And to me, I'm not going to expect that from Joe Biden. There's just no chance, because this is part of his ideology. He believes in the American empire. Wondering if you were satisfied by what he had to say, his explanation. I would say pleasantly surprised that he didn't really back down from all the pressure that he saw.
I would just add that he apparently kept the UK on hold for 36 hours without taking a call, which I think is, and I agree. I think the criticism of Biden is in like the rhetoric, which I think is shameful, and it's as dishonorable as you would expect coming at the end of an occupation like the one in Afghanistan, you know, blame the Afghan soldiers. But
yeah, that's right.
And so the rhetorical stuff is bad, but as far as like the continuing the pullout, I think that's salutary.
I honestly, this is the first thing that Joe Biden has done that makes me feel okay about my vote for him. Where he stands on the filibuster and all these other things, this bipartisanship, that still gives me nightmares, saying that I voted for this guy who's going to stand by and watch our voting rights go to hell because he doesn't want to confront the filibuster. But when I see him stand firmly in this, however he got here, I don't know what it is that got Joe Biden to the point where he is now saying, no, we're not going to be the global police. America, F no. No, we're not going to do that. And he's saying we're going to stand down. And he's standing by it despite the backlash. I mean, lesser politicians would cave underneath the pressure of all the mainstream media pounding the drums of war. Joe Biden is old enough and honorary enough to say, no, I don't care. We're coming. We're pulling out. So I actually salute him for that, because a lesser president would cave under the pressure.
Obama would have caved under the pressure. Like,
I didn't say that. You said that. I didn't say
that. Oh, my goodness. I mean, but think about that, right? I mean, think about how he was terrified of this very situation playing out. And there's a part of Biden, I think, that has like resentment towards what he perceives as some of these kind of elitist types. He, mm-hmm. despite being in Washington for a long time, still likes to think of himself, even if he doesn't act this way in practice, as, you know, middle class Joe, train riding Joe, you know, union Joe, even though, mm-hmm. again, he could do a ton more in that area. But at least aesthetically, he doesn't necessarily find the arguments convincing of the, you know, people who are on Harvard Law Review or the National, mm-hmm. Security Establishment. I think that kind of that played into this a bit.
I think, you know, when you consider back when Joe Biden opposed the surge, he actually was very vocal going on the record opposing Obama's surge, mm-hmm. Into Afghanistan. I think Joe Biden had his own sense of international relations that was separate from Obama, and now he's getting a chance to implement it. And whereas now, and I want to be sure, let's not forget that he dropped bombs on Syria within the first 3 months of his presidency, or 4 months of his presidency. Right. So this is not to say that Joe Biden is a paragon of anti-militarism, or he's standing up against the military industrial complex, but it is to say, if you take away the trillions of dollars that we were given to the defense contractors that are inside of Virginia, if you want to know where those trillions of dollars went, they didn't go over to Afghanistan. They stayed right here in the United States and went to defense contractors. And Joe Biden is most certainly going head to head with them in this particular war. But they might not be too mad at him, because we have plenty of other wars where they could spend their bombs.
And we should say also, at the very least, he is continuing a disastrous foreign policy in regards to Cuba. He has, mm-hmm. doubled down in that area, right. In Venezuela. I would imagine his fingerprints are going to be all over the government that comes out of what's happening in Haiti right now. So
that's right.
There are many, many continuations. So in terms of Cuba, Obama was an upgrade there. But
that's right.
This particular conflict and the humanitarian disaster that was Afghanistan, I think as people who are not invested in personality types on the left, we're invested in policy outcomes. That's it, right. Behooves us to be praising him a bit here.
To at least reckon, at least let's look at how he got here. Like, what pressures? Because when you consider all the other conflicts that are going on, I am not going to sit here and say Joe Biden is an anti-war president. Joe Biden is merely an anti-Afghanistan war president. So let's study that. What led him there? What pressures led him to being willing to take it on the chin from the media, as well as the military industrial complex and the reputation of the United States? But he stood by it. If we've studied that and figure out what those pressures are, then we should replicate it for every other war that is currently going on.
And where he also needs to be pressured is student loan debt. So he announced yesterday or this morning that he's basically canceling over 300,000 people's student debt, federal debt, for disabled individuals, which totally proves that he can do it for anybody, because he's been hiding behind the legal authority. Do I have the legal authority to cancel debt? I have the legal authority in a pandemic to pause payments and pause interest, but for some reason I need to consult for months and months and months about the legal authority about canceling student debt. And the fact that he's done it for a specific subset of people, like, what law is he pouring over that allows him to do it for 300,000 disabled people? It's over, you know, I think it's around $5.8 billion in debt. That's great. That precludes him from doing it in mass for the rest of people.
That's the game. See, this is why I still get anxiety and acid reflux over my vote for Joe Biden, because he's still on the opposite side of that equation playing that particular game, as my microphone falls. He's playing that specific game where he's trying to triangulate and figure out what's the bare minimum I can do to keep the people from rebelling, right? Let's give them the sensation that I am going to do something about student loans, but by making it such a myopic group that it really makes what it took for him to do that for that subgroup is the same amount of work that it would take for him to cancel it for everyone. And so he's consciously and actively making a decision to do only enough to keep the masses from rebelling. And so to that end, no, Joe Biden still has a lot more work to do. Thank you for getting us out of Afghanistan, but we still have our eye on you, Joe.
I have an optimistic take on this, and I'm generally as cynical as you are.
Oh, wow, yes, what a twist.
I agree typically that Biden basically doesn't want to do any of this stuff, whether it's a $15 minimum wage or whatever, because the national restaurant industry and lobbying groups like that are in his ear, and they want to have him get people, they want people to like submit more applications and be forced to work for them. So I think that's generally, he wants to keep people working. And debt is a good way to do that. But I've heard a theory that this might be a testing the water type of thing to see if what kind of splash this gets off, and then he actually does something more substantial. Now, that's really optimistic, and Biden hasn't really done anything during his presidency that would suggest that that's a good bet to put your money on. But as somebody with a lot of student loan debt, I will take anything I can get.
I want to thank you for saying it like that, because here's one thing that I noticed that is happening with the pullout from Afghanistan. Joe Biden is demonstrating that he has the strength to take the pressure, right? So to that end, could I see your theory working where he's testing, he's doing a weather balloon for student debt cancellation? Okay, let's stand back and watch. But I know what is helpful is that since Joe Biden has demonstrated that he can handle the pressure, let's crank the pressure all the way up so that he can respond in kind. I think he's a reactionary president in the best way possible, which is if we pressure him to do the right thing, maybe he'll do it.
Yeah, I think there's no use in crediting him, because this is like, you know, what he said about, we're going to stop offensive actions in Yemen. That amounts to a press release. He's basically a press release president at this point. Mm. And he loves that credit of like, oh, look at this FDR 2.0 coming through. And so I do think like credit is not the right posture. But also that we might be able to get something is if you expand it enough is, I think, a better one.
Yeah. I think so too. Pressure the hell out of them.
Right. And here I'm curious about your take on this as well. You know, the WHO has been vocally critical about the Biden administration's decision and the United States moving forward with booster shots. Mm-hmm. With global vaccine apartheid, I mean, that gulf is just going to widen. So I am understanding of what the Biden administration is trying to do from their own perspective. They think it's in their self-interest to make sure the pandemic tamps down and they don't want any more Americans dying. But the obligation that we have worldwide as people are getting boosters and it's going to be available to us en masse, seemingly, in a few months, the most immunocompromised are already beginning to get them. And in September, it's going to roll out a little bit more. You know, what is the Biden administration's responsibility in this area?
Well, see, now this is where I am completely at odds with the Biden administration, because they set the tone and the tenor that we would be getting back to normal and that school will be opening up and that we should look for school to open up back at capacity. That is a message from the Biden administration that I absolutely yell at the top of my lungs that you're dead wrong on that. Mm-hmm. And now tying it back to the booster shots and their responsibility. Listen, whatever the science says, if they're selling us, we need booster shots at this point, which they are saying, let's do it. Right. The Biden administration's responsibility, though, is to obviously communicate that message, But don't communicate that message while simultaneously allowing these things that are exacerbating the pandemic to continue, which is the ridiculousness of the governors forcing states to not have mask mandates, or the kind of language and rhetoric that is undermining the vaccine. Like, there's a lot of things that are happening simultaneously that, whereas the Biden administration is on the right side on one side of the equation, they're really allowing this pandemic to spread by not nipping everything else in the bud and confronting it head on. Like, you know, booster shots are great, but you know what else is great? A mask mandate.
So, like, what group of people is, and I know I don't have kids, you have kids. Like, where are you seeing this anecdotally, this push to return to schools? Because a lot of what I've seen this come from are well-off people, mm-hmm. not necessarily people who I think can't necessarily afford it. It's a lot have been driven by upper middle class, upper class parents, mm-hmm. from what I've heard. Again, this is anecdotal. And then now we're seeing no masks in schools, return in full capacity, protests from the Republican grassroots at PTA meetings.
Yeah.
You're in Georgia. What have you seen when it comes to your own kids and schools as a parent?
It's eerily the same thing that I see as I speak with my sister, who has been a teacher, or sisters, who all three of them have been teachers for over 20 years each. And they're all, you know, different varying degrees of being in administration and classroom. And what they're telling me is this: it's the same thing that we see here in Georgia, same thing we're seeing across the country, is that there's primarily three groups who are involved in the going back to school phenomenon. And you nailed the first one, which is rich people who just really don't feel like being bothered with their kids. Now, they're not going to send their kids to public school, but they still want their kids to go to some type of institution during the day because they just don't want to be with their kids. The second group are those working class parents who the mother's working, the father's working, or whatever combination thereof. And they absolutely need someone to where to put their kids so that they can go to work. I believe this is the group that the government is absolutely targeting the most, because these are the people that are going to go back into the factories, go back into the call centers, and carry out their daily duties in order to help these billionaires hit their quarterly profit margins. And they're also the same people who are going to go out and consume, spend money in traffic, in gas. And if those people are not pushed back into the system because their kids need to stay at home, well, then everything falls apart. And then the third group that she was talking about, it escaped me, but I think we can really break it down to those two groups. Those who don't feel like dealing with their kids, but those who don't have any choice because they're forced to go out into the labor force.
And I understand that it's hard, and say you want schools to return in capacity or whatever. All right, masks. Like, it's just so much of this right. is projection by these parents that we're seeing protesting, getting so up in arms about their kids having to wear masks. Oh, it's suffocating them, as we're seeing that the Delta variant might have, might be affecting kids more. We're talking, your kid might be suffocated a little bit more than wearing a mask if they have COVID. Like, that might make it a little harder for them to breathe. I'm not sure if they're aware of that.
They don't care. To them, there's an intersection of a gross level of religiosity, conspiracy theory, and I don't want to say derangement, but another word escapes me at this moment. That intersection is what gives us the anti-vaxxers, the QAnon conspiracy theorists. And these are the intersections that we're seeing at these school board meetings, where they are screaming at the top of their lungs with so much conviction and passion over the exact thing that's going to get their children killed.
Right.
That's what's blowing me away. The science will protect their children. They are advocating at the top of their lungs the exact opposite, which is going to get their children killed. So I think we need to understand that we're dealing with a different breed of human here, the ones that have suspended with all sense of primal or paternal instinct to preserve the lives of their children.
Do you see this effort by, say, Republican politicians and Republican pundits about it being, you know, Tucker Carlson calling it child abuse for kids to wear masks? It's engaging this evangelical base, this anti-science base, they often overlap, on a very grassroots level. And mm-hmm. I think it's a clear way to engage people in politics. When you're saying it's child abuse, it's part of why people were drawn to QAnon, right? It yeah. sounds like the kids are being abused. You have to go after the elites. It really is, from my perspective, a way to get people involved in politics on a level that is so emotional to them. And so now if you're going to your local PTA meeting, you know what you're also probably doing? You're probably voting for a Republican politician on the state level. You're probably doing everything you can, protesting, voting for Republicans on the federal level as well. What's your take there?
The difficult thing about it is that it is presented in a way that gives them a sense of righteousness and they feel like they're on the right side. It ties into that, like you said QAnon, it ties into the idea that they're saving the children. I think there is a level of intentionality in what is promoted. And I want to be specific here. These conspiracy theories require financial support. These conspiracy theories are not so popular that they're able to break through the algorithm themselves. A lot of these conspiracy theories have funding behind them. Isn't it ironic that none of the conspiracy theories ever come to a conclusion that is ever a threat to capital, that is ever a threat to power, that is ever a threat to the people who are actually engaging in our system in a way that could be detrimental to our children? It's always something that is a sleight of hand, like a chimera, something to go, a red herring, to go and chase this boogeyman. Meanwhile, the real villain has always been underneath the mask that the kids, you know, the pesky kids from Scooby-Doo. It's always the real life person. Who's
no pun intended about the masks.
Exactly.
No pun intended about the masks, Ben, right?
So there you go.
Yeah. So I'm... It's just like the next cultural conspiracy that they're trying to get people involved in. It was gay marriage. It was trans rights. It's
that's right.
People coming over the border. And now it's, oh, your kids are being suffocated in schools.
It is always a sleight of hand, right? It is the war on Christmas. They get so mad about the imaginary war on Christmas that they literally are ready to risk their lives over it. This is the masterwork of Republican propaganda. They have a way of getting, and this is exactly what you hit on. Those people who show up to the school board meetings are more likely to vote Republican, right? Because they have created a derangement and a conspiracy theory that is never a threat to Republican or conservative power. It's never a threat to capital. It's never a threat to the oligarchs. It is always a threat to reason and ration and logic, right? Even to the self of self-preservation. So we're dealing with people who have created the perfect narrative to get people engaged in politics in the exact opposite way than they should. And that's what we've been seeing across the country with these mask protests.
Yeah, and it's also interesting to me because, like, Republicans always will, in this sense, they're not necessarily that focused on getting everybody vaccinated so that capital is protected. They're seeing it more of as a long-term strategy where if we engage our base on this level, then we can further deregulate the state, we can further give tax cuts, and it's fine if, yeah, temporarily things have to take a hit because people aren't vaccinated. And also, I mean, when you have Republican governors, it doesn't matter. They're pushing people back to work anyway. So they think they can have their cake and eat it too when it comes to the financial ramifications of the pandemic for them.
It's funny. I believe they think that they have enough bodies to go through and grind through the dust, grind to the dust and still be able to hit their quarterly profit margins. They don't see losing a million people as a threat to their business plan. They see 30 million people being able to, or whatever number of people being able to stay home to protect themselves from the pandemic as a threat to their business plan. And so their cost benefit analysis really says we can sacrifice X number of human beings in order to maintain our quarterly profit margins during the pandemic. And I believe the government, the United States government, is complicit step by step with that, that cost benefit analysis.
Well, before we let you go, let's talk a little bit about Haiti. You mentioned that your co-host experienced loss in Haiti.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry to hear that. The numbers that keep coming out of what we've seen in Haiti, over 2,100 deaths as of the last count yesterday. Thousands and thousands are homeless now. Today, the AP is reporting that a major, I think there's only two or three oxygen production facilities which are necessary to fight COVID, has been severely damaged. The one that services Port-au-Prince, major city in Haiti. Talk about what what you've covered on your show and also just the larger ramifications.
You know, we actually took, in solidarity with our co-host Rebecca, we took 2 days off this week. We tried to cover it on Monday, but it was just too much. We came back yesterday and I was on yesterday and we covered it a bit. And then we, you know, I took this morning off because it is a lot. The Haiti has been through so much. Part of what a part of what Haiti has been through has been the insult to injury. That is, natural disaster is not enough for empathy to be given to the people of Haiti. This system has always been willing to give insult to injury, namely the Red Cross. In 2010, taking almost $500 million worth of donations and only delivering some 8 houses, when that kind of money could have rebuilt the entire city of Port-au-Prince. The Clinton Initiative, the Clinton Global Initiative, going down there and being a part of the exploitation of Haiti during their toughest time in 2010. And then after the assassination of the president, Jovenel Moïse, seeing the insult to the injury of this earthquake being commented on by so many white conservative evangelicals as a statement of Haiti being cursed is the biggest insult of them all, because that's been a narrative. As we look at all the different things that has happened to Haiti, the narrative that is being forwarded by the religious community, particularly the white religious community, is that it's because Haiti broke free from the bonds of slavery. And therefore, because of the violent revolution that occurred in Haiti, they are now cursed. That has been something that has been overbearing it's just way too heavy on us this week. But I just want to make sure that I say it here, like anywhere else. Haiti did break the curse, and that curse was the curse of slavery and colonialization and white supremacy. And that's what Haiti broke. What's happening now in Haiti are a series of natural disasters that there have been plenty of white folks and white supremacists who've been happy to exploit it. And some of them come in the form of the Red Cross.
Or in the Clinton Foundation, as you mentioned. I mean, isn't it amazing the arrogance that once Bill Clinton left office, they were like, well, you know, we're going to set up a charitable foundation that maintains Haiti as like a perfect haven for capitalism and also our own influence. We just really enjoy having total influence over their government. It's just like the arrogance of that blows my mind, especially given how much Haiti has suffered at the hands of colonialism and slavery. The idea that these power brokers feel entitled to exert their influence there, it's just nuts.
It's fascinating to see how people are willing. I guess I don't feel like I would be in good standing with the universe if I went to a earthquake ravaged nation and exploited them and use their pain as a moment for profit. But then again, we're dealing with a system that does that on an everyday basis in our healthcare system. So I'm not surprised that we would see organizations go down there and it be exploitative. I hope that now that we see the tragedy that's just happened over this past weekend, we would have learned from our mistakes in 2010. And instead of sending a dime to organizations like the Red Cross or allowing the influencers of the Clinton Global Initiative to be beneficiaries off the pain of the people of Haiti, I hope we've learned our lesson enough to tell them to stay the hell out of Haiti and let us get the work done.
Yeah, I mean, Haiti has the most NGOs. I don't know if this is still true, but it was true a few years ago, the most NGOs per capita, which is not a good statement on NGOs.
No. No, certainly not. I mean, so, yeah, again, I will let you go in a sec, Ben, because I know I hear your kids running around a little bit back there, but they've been good. They've been good.
They've been doing pretty good.
They've been pretty good. So to let them know I gave them the thumbs up. I'm sure that means a lot to them. So, I mean, where do you see this going a bit? Because obviously there are so many things in flux in Haiti in terms of the government, in terms of the wake of this earthquake, which was just, they were just hit by a massive tropical storm after, as thousands and thousands were homeless. There's so much in flux here. And of course, the Biden administration, I would imagine, is just like a praying mantis, just getting ready to pounce in terms of it exerting United States influence. Where do you see that?
This is when I honestly say I don't know. It's unfortunate that it depends on what position the United States takes towards Haiti. because of the global influence and clearly the regional influence that America has over the island. And part of that is really the mystery of the murder of the assassination of Jovenel Moise, because he was already considered to be one of the political leaders who would work with the United States government. Generally, when we see assassinations, it's because there's somebody who was working against the United States government. This deepens the question of what actually happened with that assassination. So I honestly don't know which way this is going to go, because until we understand the nature and the cause and the root of the assassination and how does it intersect with American politics, I'm not really sure how this ends for Haiti. But I know Black folks, we're going to be fighting like hell to protect them from this monstrosity of an empire.
Well, Ben Dixon of the Benjamin Dixon Show. Ben, really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah. All right, folks. We will take a quick break, and then we will be back to wrap things up. We had an IM that I just wanted to acknowledge. I thought this was actually had to do with the school take. It was a little bit different. I'll read this later. But Das Kapital Hills says, Europe receiving 10 million COVID-19 vaccine doses produced in South Africa. That's just like, that is absolutely nuts. I mean, I don't know if we have the full figures on how the continent of Africa has been unable to have access to vaccines, but it's in the single digits still at the very least in terms of what people are experiencing there, and not being able to have access to vaccines. And that's why, look, I understand the Biden administration's decision for booster shots, but you have to pair that with a mass purchase for the rest of the globe. It's just not sufficient.
Yeah. I mean, South Africa's had a tough time with COVID too. I haven't seen this vaccine. So what, they're producing vaccines and sending them to Europe?
That's what this IMer is saying.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the global vaccine apartheid problem, as much as we try to talk about, or we choose to talk about the United States a little bit more, this is a show that covers U.S. politics mostly. I think that just needs to be on the forefront of everybody's minds, because what we're experiencing is really tough right now with Delta. There's no doubt. But a lot of that has to do with ignorant people choosing not to get vaccinated. And there are millions and millions and billions of people throughout the globe who would love to be vaccinated and are unable to be vaccinated because of policies by wealthy nations.
And particularly like copyright and things like that.
Oh, and because of Bill Gates, philanthropist Bill Gates, who is very instrumental in the fact that these are not being able to be produced quite yet as generics. But that is all the time that we have right now. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Please tune in next week, where the M-Majority Report will continue. Have a great weekend, Peacock audience. We'll see you then. And for the rest of you, we are still around. We have a great rest of the show for you. We're going to be joined by Dan from the internet, who is an old friend of mine. We're going to talk a bit about the California recall before we head into the fun half. But first, I wanted to ask Matt if you wanted to plug anything for Left Reckoning.
Oh, yeah. We had a big show with Harvey K. He stayed with us for the full... So I said I did a half hour on Mark Levin. I did an hour on the last Left Reckoning. I maybe over-egged it a little bit because I got into the bits where... So he has this best-selling American Marxism book. And one thing people might have remembered during the 2016 primary is Levin played footsie with Never Trump because he was a true Ted Cruz guy. And also he was mad at Trump for slurring at Ben Carson. But what really got his goat was when Roger Stone implied he was part of the establishment because they bought his books in bulk and gave them out as membership stuff. So that was a funny clip. So we got deep into the Mark Levine thing with Harvey K, and also we had Harvey stick around. And I got him to give us a Thomas Paine lesson in the post game. So check that out. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning. For patrons this weekend, we'll be having Emma Kinema on of the Communication Workers Association.
Emma Kinema?
I think so.
That's amazing.
K-I-N-E-M-A. I'm going to talk to her about the pronunciation.
I wish my name was that cool.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about unionizing video game workers. And so... Communication Workers of America, I think I said association. So yeah, that will be out for patrons this weekend. We'll release that for everybody in the days afterwards. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to support what we do.
Awesome. And don't forget to check out Noma Key's show. It's Femme Friday. That's the name of her her Friday stream for women. I believe it's happening. And do we have Dan? All right. We are joined by almost here. There he is. Oh, you're muted, Dan. We are joined by Dan from the internet, a dear friend of mine. He is the host of Power Report and also Audio Face, which I don't know anything about music, but you know a lot, and so that's why you have a podcast on it.
Thank you. We know so much about it. We've done 200 episodes as of next week. So folks can check that out at youtube.com/audiofacepod. But it's so great to be with you, Emma.
So great for you to join us. I'm really glad we were able to do this because, you know, you're a friend of mine. I kind of like you, just a little bit, though. And I couldn't think of somebody better to talk about the California recall because I'm like pretty, I'm a bit ignorant about it. I haven't been following it to the same degree. And I'm sure you have a lot of thoughts.
Well, I mean, things have been so interesting on your end with New York. I don't blame you, honestly.
Yeah, we're a little bit preoccupied with the with everybody having to resign their status as a homosexual.
Oh God, yeah. Had a lot of interesting conversations with folks about how. I mean, I don't mean to be the told you so person, especially during these really like difficult times, but like we were kind of cringing at the Cuomo sexual stuff a long time ago. And hey, just got to do it. But
you've got to forgive people for bad takes on Cuomo from that time. Some of us weren't thinking straight.
Yeah, absolutely. But some of us have had come to Jesus moments, and that's totally fine.
Yeah.
But it's okay for people to be ignorant kind of the California governor's race, because that's kind of my concern as well, is that everyone is ignorant about this race, like including Californians. I honestly hadn't looked at the polls until kind of like as an experiment last night before, just to see, okay, how bad is it? Because recall efforts, and I'm happy to go through this to the extent to which you want to in a moment throughout the history of California, they more or less haven't worked. The one fluke time they did, we got the governator, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and that was an interesting case. But I want people to know how big the stakes here, at least before we go in.
Yeah.
The way the ballot works is like this. Most people get it vote by mail like it was in the year last year in 2020 because of like COVID-19 restrictions and things like that. And it'll get two options. Option one, do you want to recall Gavin Newsom? Yes or no? I am a very progressive person. There's an episode of Power Report that Emma joined me on where we are just like taking dunks on Newsom and Cuomo. And like, I really do not like Newsom as a person, but I encourage leftists, progressives, people who want like any inkling of California to remain somewhat stable and actually be like what it can be, which is a trailblazer for progressive and leftist agendas that can then take tune in the rest of the country. We need to keep Gavin Newsom in office. You need to vote no on that recall effort. However, if you disagree for whatever reason, if you're like one of the conservatives who are really upset about whatever thing, we can go into it later.
Yeah.
The second option is, okay, if you do want to recall Gavin Newsom, who is it? And then you get like a CVS receipts, like a really long list of candidates going
over
in there.
40, right?
Yeah, it's some ridiculous number. They had to whittle it down at some point. But you have five or six front runners. Thankfully, Caitlyn Jenner does not seem to be one of them. But it's a huge mess.
Yeah. So, okay, you mentioned that this is the second recall in the state's history, and then it was successful with Arnold Schwarzenegger. So, right? Is that accurate? Yeah. So, yeah. So what was that? What happened there?
So, for folks who don't know, California really prides itself on having a direct democracy, like, kind of system, not only through, like, ballot measures and propositions, which are now pretty common around the United States when it comes to election time, but also with recalls. I think when it comes to state elected officials overall, there have been 179 recall attempts. And with governors, there have been 54 attempts to do recalls. And of course, that one fateful one worked with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Essentially, what's really like on the ground here in California is that the recall process is abused. I don't really see it used by Democrats as often as it is by Republicans, though it very much can be. But anytime you have a candidate who has not really been in office that long, who is like someone who you already didn't like, and you're just upset that they won and they have left of center values, not all the times that much progressive, they start gathering signatures, standing outside of grocery stores, etc., trying to, you know, get this recall effort, because they know there's a snowball's chance in hell that occasionally these things work. And so that happened with Gray Davis in 2003. To be real, I'm a little bit too young to remember the exact circumstances of what happened, but
rock on,
I do
young gang here.
Young gang here. Making Sam Cedar feel old on holiday, but like,
well, yeah, I'll send this clip to him later.
Amazing. But
and
like,
I love when you say on holiday, because it reminds me of your British roots. You totally revealed that part to the audience by accident.
That's the thing. I usually that's one of the few words that has stayed, because vacation, Americans don't use theirs enough, hint hint, but also we don't like get them enough, and that's a separate political issue.
Right.
But holiday is just so fancy. It's like, I've just created my own holiday. It just happens to be this long weekend that I'm taking at work or whatever.
Yeah. It should be nationally enshrined. Continue.
Yeah. I saw a good post that was like, thank God for the weekend, and it was like, no, thank unions. But nevertheless, so Arnold Schwarzenegger won by, I want to say, in that recall effort. So they voted A, yes, to recall Gray Davis. And then B, in that recall effort, Arnold Schwarzenegger won, I want to say, around 50-55% of the vote. So like, that was pretty good. But I want people to understand that if that first question on the ballot, do you want to recall Gavin Newsom or not? Enough people vote yes on that, 50% plus one. Then that just triggers like a rat race, essentially, for question two, because all you need is a plurality of people who are like voting for that person to get recalled to win. So that means like you could feasibly have a situation where like Larry Elder or one of these like folks who we can talk about later on, who's polling around like 19-20%, they could hold that 19-20% of that, like, yes, let's recall and pick him out of all the options vote. And in one of the most barely democratic methods possible, with as few people participating in the political process that we could possibly ever see in this kind of effort right now, you could have one of these Republican kooks as governor. And that would erode a lot of the progress that has happened in California as a result of successive Democratic terms. I'm not saying things are perfect. There are things on this recall effort that I think are justified. And again, like, I can go at Gavin Newsom from the left very hard, but this is one of those situations where we're at a crossroads where there is no other Democratic option. So we have to be real about our like electoral strategy.
Right. So, I mean, was there ever a viable or whispers of a Democratic option? I know that there's nobody who really stepped up to the plate, and Newsom has a pretty significant hold on the state Democratic Party. But was there ever a thought? Because a lot of the reasoning behind this recall effort centers around that dinner he had, right, which was violating COVID rules. Seems a bit flimsy, and I would imagine that a lot of other Democrats violated COVID rules during that time anyway.
And a lot of other Republicans, mind you, the same Republicans that are upset about this whole recall effort. But yeah, you ask a really interesting, you make a lot of interesting points there. I'll try to address them. I think one thing about the recall effort behind it, there definitely weren't any Democrats who were, I mean, there were some rumblings of Democrats. There's someone who's on the, running in the recall side named Kevin Paffrath. I haven't heard of him that much, but he's apparently a YouTuber, does real estate stuff, but he's like kind of like a obnoxious centrist kind of candidate. He's saying he's running as a Democrat because he wasn't allowed to run as a Democrat, which is kind of true. As you were alluding to, Gavin Newsom has a really strong hold in the Democratic Party, not just being governor for a couple years, but being lieutenant governor under Jerry Brown, who himself was governor in the 80s, and himself was part of a political dynasty of families in California, along with Nancy Pelosi. So there's a lot of like family politics going on here too. But I think in this recall effort, the Democratic Party wanted to, the establishment of the party wanted to align for sure and make it clear that they wanted to be unified in this effort, because the Republicans were obviously going to throw everything against the wall. And alluding to the French Laundry thing, the recall effort actually officially doesn't even include COVID-19 and the handling of COVID-19 in its official reasoning for the petition, because as I was saying, recall efforts happen in California all the damn time. They're alarmingly easy to do. And so as a result, this recall effort happened shortly or like before COVID-19 was even really taking hold. Just general grievances about Gavin Newsom. Some of them included, as I get my notes right here, they claim that prisoners were ripping off the state, although they weren't talking about the private prison companies. They're saying like the individual prisoners at commissary or whatever.
That makes sense for their ideology. That's kind of a crystallization.
Yeah, high taxes, debt, even though we're in a little bit of a surplus right now. And I'll get to more on that later, because Gavin Newsom's response on this is awesome. And what he's doing with that surplus is very awesome. But and semi-ironically, semi-unironically. And there were some things that you could see as moderately progressive, like there's issues with affordable housing, which I think are an issue all over the country, and it could be done more on a federal level. But certainly Gavin Newsom could address that on a state level. And issues with fracking, Gavin Newsom during COVID-19 initiated and allowed certain fracking permits to continue to happen in California, in a state that is being hit very hard by climate change, fires, the like, and in a state where Gavin Newsom as a progressive was trying to run on a climate forward kind of platform. But yeah, overall, you had this Democrat, it's a really kind of a test case to show the Democratic Party's establishment's hold on the state. And it kind of breeds, and I think this sort of breeds on a national level as well, a kind of complacency among a lot of the voters, a lot of the constituents, maybe like the mainstream viewers of the Democratic Party, if you will, that are just not understanding how close the situation is. Like 538 literally has this within 1% or so margin of error of going either way. So this needs to kind of be an, unfortunately, Democratic people who are left of center need to unite on this in California and make sure that Gavin Newsom is not recalled.
Well, some of the candidates are nuts, right? Like you have standard Republican, they're all nuts, but you have standard Republicans like Kevin Faulkner, so former mayor of San Diego. You have Kevin Kelly, Republican state assemblyman. Yeah, they're all nutty, but like in the Republican Party. And then you have Caitlyn Jenner, who's gotten a lot of press, even though I thought that she left to do Celebrity Big Brother, but she's still running. I mean, kind of a lateral move to do Celebrity Big Brother, I would say.
I mean, it's a little bit fast to pivot to the TV show. Usually you wait till after you've lost, right? Like,
yeah,
I don't know. It's a new generation. I don't know these like new heads out here. It's a new game.
A new generation. I mean, she's a little bit on the older side. I feel like she tries to be likable in every way, and yet comes off. The whole I see homeless people from my helipad situation. It couldn't get worse than that. But then I saw this compilation of clips of conservative radio host Larry Elder, who actually is Elder, I should say, is running. Do we have that, Bradley? Yeah, let's watch this, Dan. More Perfect Union, which was put together by a few people, including Josh Miller Lewis, who I know from Bernie's staff, great people. They put this compilation together of who Larry Elder really is and it's not pretty.
During slavery, a black kid was more likely to be born under a roof with his biological mother and biological father than today. That's the problem.
I've told you that the minimum wage has racist origins.
The Democrats' refusal to even consider the privatization of Social Security.
It is outrageous that the Democrats believe that Donald Trump is a racist.
This is Larry Elder, a right-wing radio host and regular Fox News commentator with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Sound familiar?
You could be a kind of drain the swamp governor. A bit of Trumpian philosophy comes to Sacramento.
On September 14th, Californians will vote in a Republican-led recall election to oust Governor Gavin Newsom. And right now, Larry Elder is leading the pack of contenders to replace him. With polls tightening, Elder could very well be elected if a majority of voters don't oppose the recall of the governor.
Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom faces a recall election.
Organizers say they've submitted over 2 million signatures supporting a move to oust him.
So who is Larry Elder, and what does he believe? Larry Elder has called Roe v. Wade one of the worst decisions that the Supreme Court ever handed down, and threatened to fire thousands of public school teachers if he's elected. He also opposes the minimum wage.
Regarding the minimum wage, the correct minimum wage ought to be zero.
How do you think California voters currently earning the minimum wage would react to that?
Well, given the indoctrination that people have about the minimum wage, they probably wouldn't react to it well.
And when it comes to the environment, Elder all but denies that climate change is responsible for the massive fires that rage across California every year.
Because of the stranglehold the environmentalists have had on Sacramento for the last 20 or 30 years, anti-oil and gas, anti-water.
Believe that fires, for instance, in California have gotten worse because of climate change.
I'm not sure it's because of climate change. Fires have gotten worse because of the failure of this governor.
With the COVID-19 pandemic still rampant, Elder says he will lift mask mandates and COVID testing requirements if he's elected.
No state worker is going to be required to take a test once a week and be required to wear masks.
He's in robes all the time.
He recently had an anti-vaccine physician on his show, trumpeting conspiracy theories about the virus.
You know, Bill Gates, he's behind things like this.
Right.
So he wants population control. So I ultimately don't have a lot of trust in what they're doing.
So how does the recall actually work?
Okay, we're good. We're good. Yeah. Thank you. So, I mean, that was a pretty good encapsulation of Larry Elder. Anything to add?
I will say that he once said that women just inherently know less than men about, you know, current political, economic, social events. I think I was actually going to say the dynamic between you and I on camera is a complete like counterexample to that, because I know considerably less than you about many of these things. I go back with Larry Elder because I'll expose some of my political nerddom here, but I'll kind of like throw my mom under the bus. Like, because like in the mornings, sometimes like on the way to school, she would play like, you know, liberal talk radio, and so that's kind of how I vaguely know of Air America and Sam Cedar in that way. So there, I can like throw into that way. I was in kindergarten or whatever, and my kid was listening to Stephanie Miller and Sam Cedar and stuff like that. But Randy Rhodes as another shout out there. But there's also Larry Elder very much on the microphone as well, and my father was a little more on the conservative side, and so I'd hear a little bit of that. And dude's had he's had this sort of libertarian streak for the longest. And back when you were on Power Report a couple months ago, we sort of had this thing that, look, obviously Republicans would not like the idea of Caitlyn Jenner because they're horrendously transphobic, but it would not be below them to like callously like use shallow identity politics to like Trojan horse their like far right agenda in the state of California.
They're trying to do it with Herschel Walker right now.
Yeah, survey says like they will throw anything to the wall and see what sticks. And like I guess like can't knock the hustle to some extent, but this is really what's at stake. Like I said, we have a 1% back or forth like difference between keeping Gavin Newsom as governor, and I'd have to, if we get any more time, like to talk about the things that he's done under pressure now from the recall.
538 has it as of the 17th as a keep plus 0.12. as you said. Yeah. It's a 1 point, and that's, of course, it could be going either way, especially if Republicans are more galvanized. Like, and that's kind of how these recalls, that must be a bit of the dynamic too, right, Dan? That if it's a recall election, the people that are going to be most excited about that are going to be conservatives in California, and so that automatically favors the person calling for the recall.
Exactly. And so kind of going back to the French Laundry thing,
that's the name of the restaurant he was caught dining at, flouting his own COVID guidelines.
Yeah, for his own birthday, right? And so he was really under fire because, you know, Republicans really hate hypocrisy and they love calling that out on their side, psych. But they'll definitely use it to call it out on the Democratic side to, get political points. And obviously those are bad optics. And Gavin Newsom was sort of seen as like a dictatorial figure, always doing these sort of like mask mandates. But on the flip side, California, during its worst bouts of COVID, has, with its large population, with its like large population centers, Los Angeles, San Francisco, like the lesser discussed ones, like in the Central Valley, et cetera, like Bakersfield, COVID like death rates could have been much worse, but I think it was a lot of Gavin Newsom and a lot of the other Western states, like kind of tougher restrictions that for a time, yeah, no one liked the restrictions, but I think we all like being alive, those of us that do, and those of us who have loved ones who died or are still affected by COVID-19 can definitely sympathize with efforts that were made to save lives. But yeah, nevertheless, it was used as a political tactic. And I'll also say this, because of this initiative, it wouldn't have gotten enough signatures on the ballot. But a judge ruled in California that because of the COVID-19 restrictions, there was a 4-month extension on gathering signatures, because the situation of COVID-19 and people being mandated to like stay at home as much as possible, et cetera, would have made it naturally difficult to get signatures. So they were granted additional time. They were allowed to spur up more of this like COVID-19 things, find more things about Gavin Newsom to be upset with, and then like continue this process to where we are today.
Right. So I'm looking at the polling right here. As you mentioned, Elder is in the lead by a not insignificant number. He's plus 10.2, and there are other candidates in the field. So I guess let's talk a little bit more about him. He's emerged as the front runner, which is crazy.
not clearly, great, folks.
Yeah, I mean, clearly Californians, despite having the reputation and voting very vociferously against Trump, they're okay with a big-mouthed host who doesn't really have any experience communicating these kinds of talking points or this kind of rhetoric, and that resonates with some people, probably Republicans in the state. So there are a lot of conservative pockets in California. People don't necessarily realize Orange County is obviously infamously a bit more conservative, but when you get to the northern parts of the state, there are areas there. Like, what's your sense of that? What's your sense of his candidacy and why it's sticking with some people? Why he's emerged as a front runner here?
Oh, yeah. I'll also remind folks of the dynamic that a severe minority of people at the end of the day can successfully elect Larry Elder into office if question one is answered in the affirmative that, yes, you want to recall Gavin Newsom. So this underscores the importance of voting no. But, like, I think on the Republican side, like I said, they're a lot about optics. Having a black figure so they can say they're not racist to a lot, or they can like shut down a lot of those arguments in California is a good thing. Having a like a figure with name recognition and a media figure is another thing that Republicans love. It's straight out of the playbook. But yeah, that being said, a lot of his statements wouldn't sit right with even the most like, like a lot of folks, I will give a rare kind of defense of Orange County here, especially because you see a lot of nonsense in like Huntington Beach with protests and things. But you get a lot of people who are like, when it gets down to it, when you just like do the way politics is supposed to be done, not like people in suits behind closed doors, but, you know, safely within politics, like knocking on doors, talking to people, events organizing. You get people who have been told to their parents like the, you know, fiscally conservative nonsense, but they talk it out and they want more funding for schools. They want more like legalization and like funding for certain things that will get me flagged on YouTube. So I'm not going to say them out loud.
I very much appreciate that. We can't even say CBD on the show without getting flagged, if you understand what I'm trying to say.
That's called YouTube professionalism. Yes, how you know you've been in the business for a minute. But I mean, like, The also big thing, speaking of YouTube professionalism, that we kind of have an intimate understanding with is that the plus and the minus of you being a political pundit running for office is that everything you've said is very readily accessible and can be used against you in a political ad.
What are you talking about?
I would possibly have no idea anything that could possibly intersect with our previous workplaces, but and love the folks who were there. It's no dig on them, but it's like, this was a very, that was a thing with that campaign was like, okay, he's running for office, roll the footage, and there's a ton of it. So that ultimately gets to my biggest concern. And we kind of saw this with the Nina Turner race. I talked with Jordan Yule on Power Report recently about this, and he noted that I think the turnout for Democrats in that race was 16%. So again, a lot of the rhetoric online on political YouTube and political Twitter and all this stuff, we're very engaged in it. I love that we're engaged in it. I hope we use that towards actual mobilization and activism. It's the smart strategic thing to do as well as this engagement. But if people aren't actually getting out to vote, and I don't see much of a get out to vote effort on Gavin Newsom and the streets or media right now, or on the internet especially, that's all you need is for enough people who are actually paying attention to vote yes on recalling Gavin Newsom, and you've unlocked the potential for Larry Elder or someone worse, or just someone definitely just worse than Gavin Newsom to be in office. And like you said earlier, the opposing side, who is more galvanized and energized to do the recall effort, has an advantage in that mobilization right there. And with the numbers this close, I'm very worried.
Yeah, I just got a message from Berkeley Girl 63 saying, does Dan have any recs for backup selection on the ballot in case the recall goes through? They all seem incompetent from every party.
First of all, shout out Berkeley. Second of all, you can also just not vote for anyone. You can choose to leave that portion blank. And I would honestly suggest that. I just wouldn't feel comfortable personally knowing that every vote does count, and a vote that isn't towards someone means that you're not personally putting your hand in the pile for anyone else. I'm not sure if any particular one would be a better choice, or any particular one who has a chance of winning would be a better choice, right? The best choice is to just vote no on the recall, because another thing is that, the Democrats united essentially to make sure that there weren't any, Bernie Sanders-esque kind of candidates who are running an insurgent campaign, for better or worse. For better in the sense that right now, when you have not a lot of people engaged or paying attention to this, even in the state of California, when it comes down to a vote, people will make the split decision. If they're Democrats, they're most likely fall in line. But it's a totally a fine option to leave that second portion blank. And in good conscience, that's what I would do.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the case. All right, well, Dan, I really appreciate your time today coming on to talk about this. We got to do it sometime soon. People should check out the Power Report.
Yes, youtube.com/Dan from the internet. And then, yes, because heavy politics and stuff breaks my brain, there's going to be an episode this weekend on, I talked to someone who is Afghan, who has family in Afghanistan, and is working really closely on the efforts of getting folks and people out of the region. And so he's been working tirelessly, and he was able to spend some time with me kind of talking about that process. And I think what's been done really well on the Majority Report, but not so well on other media outlets, really contextualizing why we're in there in the first place and what happened with the Taliban. So that'll be coming out soon on youtube.com/Dan from the internet. And yeah, because politics breaks my brain, I'm going to be listening to the new Lorde album that came out this weekend and talking about it on Audio Face 200. I don't know if you would like Lorde. I feel like you might like Lorde.
Well, I've said this a few times. My music taste is pretty plebeian. I don't necessarily have good music taste. I've been listening to a lot of, Ariana Grande recently, Dan. So it's just a little bit more I tried to be edgier in my younger years, and it didn't really stick. I'm either listening to podcasts or something that makes me want to sing along at this point. The Lorde album looked bad, though. Why? It sounded like a tampon commercial.
I haven't heard it yet, fair enough. I just have liked Lorde's previous work, and I respect her process as a musician. But I mean, I just see you as a person, like, you're, I know you're exercising a lot and in the gym, like, you're probably, yeah, I listen to podcasts too when I'm exercising, but I also like music. It keeps me going. So I'll send you some Ariana Grande adjacent things. But yeah, thank you again for
that's
having me on.
That's not all. We'll do it more. I also listen to like old school hip hop in the gym. So that gives me a little bit of like,
Yeah, you've dropped cred. I think you dropped Fugazi on an episode a couple days ago. I see you.
Yeah,
I see you. We're improving.
Well, I'm glad to know that you're watching the show.
Oh yeah, I watch it as much as I can to drop particular anecdotes to make it seem like I watch the show all the time. Yeah, love your work, love what you're doing.
Yeah, very strategic. So everyone should check out Audio Face, check out Power Report. Dan's really one of the best, even if he, you know, doesn't brag about himself enough. All right, really appreciate it, Dan. Thanks so much.
Take care. Shout out to the team as well. Y'all are great. Take care.
Appreciate it. Oh, what the hell happened?
Your camera. Oh no, people can see the border, the sort of messiness of the office in the corner.
Oh, I know. Damn it.
Behind the curtain.
How did that even happen? And I'm trying to zoom in and it's not working. All right, we're gonna go into the fun half, guys. See you in a bit.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.